In Session with Dr. Fadid Holakwi.
Good evening. Welcome to In Session. I'm your host, Dr. Fadid Holakwi, and I'll be with you for the next hour here on Radio Hamra. You can follow me on Twitter or Instagram, or like my page on Facebook to get updates on the show, or suggest topics or books for the program, and the shows are uploaded at the end of each week to my SoundCloud page and podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Let's get to the books of the week. The book of the week for this week that I'll talk about on next Monday's show is Night Vision by Mariana Alessandri. Night Vision, Seeing Ourselves Through Dark Moods. And as I always say, I try not to judge books by their covers and titles, but I definitely do. And that topic, seeing ourselves through dark moods, I was drawn to because I think we often focus in a lot of psychology and self-help books or focus on being happy, feeling good, which are not bad aims. But often there is this negativity bias or a positivity bias towards positive feelings and thinking that we need to ignore or get rid of our negative feelings, the ones that don't feel good, whereas they actually, I think, are quite beneficial, and we do truly know ourselves better when we're in touch with all of our feelings, and especially those ones that don't feel good, even though they make us want to go away from them. If we can go into them, we actually can learn a lot more about ourselves, and I think live a better life as a result. So I found that interesting and looking forward to reading the book and sharing it with you. Again, Night Vision by Mariana Alessandri. The book of the week from last week that I'll be talking about tonight is The Menopause Brain by Lisa Mascani. The Menopause Brain, New Science Empowers Women to Navigate the Pivotal Transition with Knowledge and Confidence. And, of course, not being a woman, I won't have to experience this personally, but half the population does, and most women will if they reach that age. And so I wanted to understand more about menopause itself, but also menopause brain here, focusing on the mental, psychological aspects that often might be overlooked. And as a psychologist, thought it'd be good for me to be more informed about that, because she touches on this earlier often in a way, this how menopause has not been studied very well, or not enough research has been done on menopause. And it's a reflection of many things, including the fact that in general, research and money is not devoted as much to women's health issues compared to men's health issues. And so there just is a lack of research overall. Also, she discusses how the way menopause has been viewed and still is very stigmatized and through a negative lens. And that also reflects sexist ideologies, namely that women were considered, I'd said, in a way still are, we're moving away from that, but especially historically, were seen as their main function was to reproduce. That's what was deemed the most important thing, and sometimes the important thing in a woman's life and their functionality, so to speak. And so when menopause hits and that's no longer possible, you see this reflected in how it has been talked about as a type of death or the end, or and so many things after that will be bad. And of course, when the quote unquote experts are telling you this, that itself will impact how you experience something you are going through. And so this book is to inform both women. Clearly the book was geared more towards women for them to understand their experience, but also to anyone else to understand better what this process is like and how, as I said, nearly half the population will go through this process to understand it better and really dispel some of the myths and also inform us more about that. So I thought that was very crucial and important, and the book is critical in that way to contribute to the dialogue and just our better understanding of this very natural process. And it reminded me of the book I read recently on periods, on menstruation, and how often women's issues are considered more inconveniences or things that we try to push aside or get rid of, rather than recognizing them as natural and healthy and normal. And similarly, menopause has often been treated as an illness rather than a natural transition and progression. It's often been treated as an illness itself, that trying to either cure it or to get rid of it or to make it disappear as much as possible. But those things are not possible. Now, that doesn't mean it isn't very important for women going through this transition to have adequate medical care and to be able to ask their questions and understand what's going on. And oftentimes things can be done to make the transition easier and better for them, but it shouldn't be treated itself as an illness. And actually, the more it is destigmatized, the more it's okay to talk about it, the easier it is for women to ask for help, support, to reach out to one another, but also to their healthcare professionals to get the support and the help that they need. So even, you know, the definitions of menopause, you know, when you hear that, it is the ending of the menstrual cycle. But, you know, she shared how the clinical definition is menopause transition is complete after 12 consecutive months since the final menstrual period. So there has to be 1 year of no periods for a woman to then be officially in menopause. But there's also perimenopause, which is the phase that starts towards the end of the menopausal transition and continues into the first year after the final menstruation period. And so sometimes people will use these terms interchangeably, even though they're not. And this is often the case, that official medical or psychological, psychiatric terminology could be different from how people colloquially use the terms. But it's important to be aware of that, especially if you're looking at research, so that you make sure you understand what it is that they are talking about when they are discussing a certain term or a certain group of the population. So again, it's something very natural and normal. And, you know, my own experience as a kid, I remember hearing, you know, you'd always hear about hot flashes as like this main symptom, and it's almost joked about, and that women would go through some changes in their mood, both of which happen, but it's often done in a comedic, exaggerated way rather than recognizing it for a very, very natural, normal experience. So there are different types of symptoms, and even, you know, we try to separate things like bodily symptoms versus mental symptoms, but as always, there is a overlap and interconnectedness there. So for example, even the hot flashes are related to the brain as well, that as she talks about, but even just the physical sensation of it, of course, is going to come with mental and psychological repercussions or aspects to it as well. But common symptoms that women go through, and as she talks about, no two women go through it the same exactly, but there are some, of course, patterns that we do see. But things like the hot flashes are very common. Also, there are risks of things like osteoporosis over time to be aware of. But the, as I mentioned, those hot flashes, they also can come with, they might occur at night or disrupt sleep. And so that can be quite an issue. I actually didn't know things like new allergies can sometimes develop around this time as well as things like thinning hair, brittle nails, dry skin, itchiness, even changes in body odor or changes in the taste or dry or burning mouth. There's all these different symptoms that people might experience, less known ones, but also ones that many women do encounter. Then, you know, she goes into, as the book itself, it's called The Menopause Brain, going into all of the psychological factors that come about that are often overlooked or undermined, or a woman going through these challenges is told, you know, one of my favorite, and that I think it's so silly, but it's all in your head, which if a change happens in your brain, that is in your head. But the way it's presented is that it's just fake or not really something to worry about, or something that you have to just get over yourself, not something real, but it is very real. But so people go through many things. There's also brain fog is common. So just feeling a little bit slower, not being able to concentrate as well, having more tip of the tongue experiences, forgetting why you, let's say, entered a room or where you put something. She used example of like losing your phone or not knowing where you put your phone. Those things can be common experiences. Also things like, there are neurological symptoms. Sometimes people have things like dizzy spells, fatigue, headaches, and migraines, but also mental health types of concerns like depression, intense anxiety, panic attacks, and even what's called electric shock sensations, like these feelings of shock in your skin can happen as well. So these are all part of, or can be part of, menopause. Again, everyone goes to them differently. As she shares, some people are very lucky and might have, let's say, very little to no hot flashes. Something like around 15% of women never have a hot flash, but many others have many more. So she, at the end of the book, which I won't get into too much, there's a lot of different recommendations. First, going into the different types of therapy, including hormone replacement therapy, which has a variety of names, but at times that can be helpful for some women. But of course, definitely anything I say now is not anything like medical advice or even recommendations. And even she makes it clear that there isn't a one-size-fits-all treatment or regimen or routine that is good for everyone. Each person has to weigh lots of different factors, what works for them, what doesn't work for them. Also, especially with hormone therapies and other types of treatments, you always have to look at things like cancer, if there is cancer risk, and sometimes those can be complicated. Even understanding, is there an increased cancer risk, or is it only for certain individuals? And so those are things to be very mindful of and aware of. And so you want to talk to your own doctor and people who are treating you to see what makes sense, or if anything makes sense for you to do. So there's a lot of information on the different types of treatments that are available. Also, recommendations for non-medical types of things, or non-treatment related things, like meditation, also exercise, and how important exercise is. You know, a lot of times these recommendations for whatever the issue might be, we see a lot of overlap, because usually things that make us healthier make all people healthier. So exercise is good for everyone. Now, there might be certain things that are better for certain people going through different challenges, but everyone benefits from exercise. It's just making sure you can do something that you can keep doing. But diet is very important. She shares a lot in length, because she's written a book, I think it was called Brain Food. So she's done extensive research on foods that are good for you and foods that are not good for you. And no surprise, but processed foods and ultra processed foods, she talked about them a bunch and how bad they are. Again, it's one of those things that's not a surprise. I don't think anyone thinks that processed food is good for you, but it's very bad for you in so many ways, including even interfering with hormones. And that could lead to impacts on things like how you experience menopause, or even what you experience in general related to your cycle and all of that. So again, it's nothing newsworthy in the sense that you're surprised to hear it, but reading in detail her getting into how bad it is, even for me, it made me more mindful. Not that I'm concerned about the specific issues related to what she was bringing up, but of how bad those foods are for us, that are unfortunately, especially in Western culture, American culture, just such a common thing we experience and common thing we eat or put in our diets, is having these kind of processed foods and thinking it's normal when it's really absolutely not normal at all. But coming back to some of these, the mental side of things. So there is some a dip in cognitive performance that women can experience during this time around menopause. But the good news is it appears that there is a bounce back a few years later. So during this menopause, perimenopause phase, there can be a dip in mental performance, cognitive performance. But what we see is that after a few years, they go back to previous scores. And so that's really good to see and to hear, that it's not something lasting and forever. Because many women, she talks about, they think what they're experiencing during menopause, and the average age is around, I think, 49 to 52 or so. But again, there's different ranges. It's not just going to be the same for everyone. But many women might think it's a type of dementia, early onset dementia that they're experiencing, and that can be very frightening, of course. When it's not that, of course, people can experience that, but for many women, it's just this experience of menopause, which could be related to estrogen production and things of that sort, can affect your cognitive functioning, but it comes back, it bounces back over time. So it's good to be aware of that, because it makes you realize that just because you're feeling that dip doesn't mean it's something that is going to last forever. Interestingly, about mood, now during this period, if you can imagine you've went through it, or you know someone has gone through it, maybe you know, you're having hot flashes, there's this big transition in your life that you're going through, and you're also having some of this cognitive changes, physical changes. So much happens during this time that understandably there's a dip in happiness. And we often hear about this, or it's expressed about how this is a sad part of life. And again, this sense before, especially, that now the rest of life is sad because you can't reproduce anymore, which is again a very male-focused mindset and ideology. But the research actually shows that there is a dip in life satisfaction, happiness around the menopause period, but we actually then see increases in happiness and well-being that come about afterwards. And so this can be actually the happiest part or period of women's life is later in life after menopause. So it does shift this paradigm and mindset that it's downhill or life is bad after this. It doesn't have to be. And actually the research shows that many women see an increase in their happiness and their life satisfaction after menopause, especially a few years after menopause. I wanted to discuss a few more things about the book before I move on, but we're at a commercial break. So again, the book is The Menopause Brain by Lisa Mascagni. Let's go to a commercial break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Continuing the discussion on the book, The Menopause Brain by Lisa Mascagni. This even title, The Menopause Brain, we do see changes in the brain. She shares some imaging studies where we see even some parts of the brain shrinking or an activity changing during a menopause. And so this can look obviously not pleasant to go through that experience of from an early menopause, we see these types of changes. But she adds that that's not the whole story, that in late menopause, we also see a bounce back. I was saying you see the same thing in cognitive performance, but actually we can see changes in the brain where some areas begin to thicken again, or there's changes that we see happening there. And she does share this sense that rather than looking at menopause as this negative thing, to recognize it more as a change that does happen. There are changes that a woman will go through physically, but also mentally, and that could be okay, rather than just thinking of it as some kind of illness. As I said, it's treated sometimes, or a deterioration. It is a transition and a change, and in some cultures, it is seen in that way, which I'll likely touch on by the end of the segment. There's also some interesting facts here and there, a lot of interesting facts, but some that I'll share. New mothers have a heightened sense of smell, and I guess that makes sense, that they're going to be more aware, or there's going to be some heightened senses in certain ways. But to the point where that almost 90% of new mothers can recognize their babies by scent alone, which is quite interesting. And also the experience of having a newborn or having a baby, many women will talk about being pregnant, having a kind of a brain fog related to pregnancy. But also once you have a child, we can see that experience, and we can also understand that experience as a new mother. You are so preoccupied with your newborn, and rightfully so, that other things are less important to you. So you will feel more forgetful, have more tip of the tongue experiences, because understandably more of your brain resources are devoted to your child and making sure your child is okay, and even anticipating needs before they happen, or even going back to this heightened type of sense, the way that fathers can do it too, but you see it even more in mothers, can interpret their child's experience in ways that, it doesn't seem possible to the naked eye. For example, oh, I know that's a cry for a diaper change, or a cry that the baby's hungry, whereas it might sound exactly the same to you. So we do see these heightened types of senses or intuition whatever you want to call it, these ways of discerning things that they weren't able to before. But as is often the case, we see it comes, there's a costs and benefits, or you have to, you give a little and you lose something somewhere else at times, but often that does bounce back or change as you transition out of that phase. And related to mothers, also about grandmothers, there was an interesting brain imaging study that she shared that also I think will maybe many parents or grandparents also can possibly relate to, but they showed grandmothers both pictures of their children but also their grandchildren and tried to see if there was differences in the brain that might give us some insights into the experience of being a mother and a grandmother. And so I'll read what she shares on that study. So when the grandmothers looked at pictures of their grandkids, the scientists witnessed brain activity in areas associated with emotional empathy, which is the ability to feel another person's feelings or to put oneself in another's shoes. But when the grandmothers looked at pictures of their children instead of their grandchildren, their brain activity relocated to areas of the brain linked with another form of empathy called cognitive empathy instead. Cognitive empathy is more about understanding another's feelings on an intellectual level, focusing not only on what someone is feeling, but on why. So we're seeing that when it was their grandchildren, the part of the brain that was being activated, the parts was more about this more emotional empathy, really feeling the pain. Whereas when it was their children, they're now adults, so they're adult children, it was more of this cognitive empathy, which is a little bit more removed. It's a bit more, well, trying to understand why are you feeling that way. And as she shares after that, many mothers might relate to this, that they see their own mothers now when they have their own kids and now their mothers become grandmothers, that they interact with their baby and their kids much differently than they interacted with themselves when they were kids. So we see this difference, and a lot of times it could be frustrating. I've seen it happen so many times in therapy where it could be mothers, but also fathers, the way that we see our parents treat our kids differently than they treated ourselves can be difficult for us to kind of process and deal with. Or sometimes I've heard people say things like, well, I'm seeing how sweet she is with my own kid, and I'm wondering, why wasn't she that sweet to me? It shows me she's capable of it, but she didn't give it to me, and it could feel personal, as often our experiences are when someone does something we don't like. But especially with our parents, we personalize that, you know, something about me, or why didn't they give me that love that I wanted, or why did they hurt me in those ways? And so a lot of parents go through that, but this gives us some insights that even in the brain, we might see different parts of the brain registering for kids versus grandkids. And it could make sense in a way that when it's your kids, she talks about this, you have a responsibility, a big responsibility, make sure they're okay, take care of them, and also focusing on raising them a certain way to make sure they're healthy, they're strong, they get what they need, but they don't get too much. But, you know, all these different things that might go into play that will make you feel much differently than with your grandkids. We kind of know this almost intuitively, or the sense that it's just, you just want to spoil them. You don't have to think about all of those things. It's not your responsibility. It's not your adult child's responsibility to do that part or have that burden, whereas you can just enjoy them and let them enjoy you. And so we see grandmothers doing that, grandparents in general. There's always that kind of it's a cliche, but very true of, okay, when you go to grandma's house, you do things you couldn't do in your own house, or you eat things that you don't get to eat in your own house. And, you know, she's the one that's spoiling you, but we can kind of understand it. But it was interesting to see a brain imaging study that might give us some understanding of how that might even work. To conclude, as I said, the book is about a topic that I think doesn't get enough attention, and women's health in general doesn't get enough attention, and not just attention as far as books like this, but research and research funding. Often she shares a lot of research throughout the book, which is great, but she'll often share that this is an area where there hasn't been research, or it's shocking that there hasn't been even one research looking at some specific aspect of menopause or what women go through or pre and post and all those kinds of things that would be really important and help us be more informed about it. So it's very unfortunate that is the case. And related to that, mindset is so important. She has the whole concluding chapters about mindset and how significant this can be in any experience we have. Just think, if you think you're going through something that marks the end of your value, or that makes you, almost it's treated as an illness, or you're going through a sickness, that's very different from transitioning into a new phase of life. And as I mentioned, many women and overall the average life satisfaction goes up after menopause. But if you could recognize that earlier, what impact that might have on you and transitioning into this new phase of life, which actually can be quite good. And many people have that good experience. And so she shares some other countries or cultures and their experience of menopause, and how it appears that because of the different ways that it is approached and viewed in different societies and cultures, the women seem to have different experiences. So for example, in Japan, she shares that they have a very different experience and actually much less likely to experience hot flashes, which is interesting. So only about 25% of Japanese women reported hot flashes, which is considerably lower than in the United States. And she shares that in general, in societies where age itself is more revered in Western culture, beauty and youth is overly weighted. Those things, of course, will have value and be wanted, but we overly focus on those and give so much weight. And especially to women, there is more of a pressure to look young, be young, and to look good in a way that makes it the most valuable part of a woman being those aspects. That's not true in all cultures. And so she shares how in cultures where age in general is more revered, and that older women, where they're considered wise and actually even superior, not that they're becoming inferior, there's a superiority there, that they're becoming even more valued members of society, that women report fewer bothersome symptoms or fewer of these painful or uncomfortable symptoms of menopause, which I think is quite interesting. And even if we look at understanding why menopause exists, often people have been puzzled about why would menopause exist? Is it just some almost evolutionary mistake that just, or the fact that we live longer, that now women can live such a big portion of their life past their reproductive capacity, or after they are no longer able to reproduce. But there are some theories that go against this. Oh, well, it's just old age or some kind of evolutionary mistake or just accident, in that there might be benefits, and it's actually called the grandmother hypothesis, that having grandmothers who no longer have to worry about their own reproducing, to take that out of the equation, and now can focus on helping with, for example, their daughters or their sons' kids, their grandkids, and that this might give an evolutionary advantage. And there's some evidence in extant hunter-gatherer societies that this does happen, that you see the grandmothers being very helpful in taking care of the young of their own children. And so now that their resources, also their bodily resources, don't have to go towards menstruation and the possibility of reproduction, this actually might be a good thing, or might be beneficial. And so the grandmother hypothesis has a lot of support. None of these things can be proven when we're trying to say what might be the evolutionary basis or why might this have evolved. It's going to be speculative at some level, but we try to see if we can piece together and get data to support different hypotheses. And there's a good amount of data supporting this notion that actually it's not that menopause is some kind of a mistake. It might actually be evolutionarily advantageous and evolved for a particular reason. So I thought that was interesting. And again, overall, is a theme of the book, or why I wanted to read the book. As I said, I was not very informed about it, especially from the psychological perspective. And I learned a lot about that, but also just about many aspects related to menopause and female health, but also things that can be done, treatments, from hormone therapies to also things looking at diet, also mental health, and how that is so key during this period, and not something to be overlooked. So Either you yourself or someone who might go through this at some point, or you'll definitely know someone who does. So I think that's important to be informed, so you better understand this significant portion or transition in the human experience. So again, the book is The Menopause Brain by Lisa Mascagni. Let's go to our last commercial break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. In the last segment, wanted to talk about, it's a holiday per se, but today is April 1st, and often that's considered April Fool's Day. And so I think in the 10 years or so that I've been doing this show, almost every year on April Fool's or around April Fool's, I talk about this topic. It's my chance to get to be a grumpy old man in some ways, but really to share some thoughts on what I see as unfortunate, the ways that people view things like pranks and jokes, and just thinking about those things in general, and just sharing some of my opinions on it. So I was actually trying to look up even the origin of April Fool's Day, and I couldn't find it. What I found was some disputed ideas about where it might come from, including from Chaucer's, I think it was Canterbury Tales, but anyway, there's other theories about where it comes from. But I remember it since I was a kid, so it's been around for a while, that April Fool's, this is a day that you can do pranks or jokes. And so maybe today you saw people post things on social media that then later turned out not to be true, to be funny, because today's the day to do that, to have these jokes. And so to begin with, I'm not against jokes in general. Again, I don't want to come off as very serious and that life should be taken only seriously and we shouldn't have fun. I'm all about having fun, joking, contrary to what I might say in the next few minutes, but I'm very much a big fan that life is about play and being playful and having fun with one another. We actually shouldn't take ourselves especially too seriously at all. And being silly is I think, an underrated quality. To be silly frequently and often, and actually, well, hopefully you could do it in front of lots of people, but those that you can be silly in front of, that's a great sign of being close with them. So hopefully we don't lose that at all. And this also relates to joking and teasing, and that also is a healthy part of relationships, that we can joke and tease one another. Again, the people that you can tease are the ones that you are closest with. You feel comfortable doing so. So I think that is very important, not something to lose sight of in all relationships, and actually even in romantic relationships. It's so important that you can tease each other, not take each other so seriously, that you can joke. Even John Gottman, who has done decades of research on marriages, he shares stories of couples who are in the middle of a fight, but then all of a sudden one of them could do something silly. This classic story I've heard is husband and wife are having a fight and the husband sticks out his tongue, which is like how their three-year-old does it at that time. And they both start laughing and they share a laugh and it diffuses the tension and actually allows them not to avoid the issue that brought up the fight, but now to address it in a more calm and connected way, which is really important. So it's so important to have humor, lightness, joking in our relationships, all of them, especially our romantic relationship. One key thing for me, though, about jokes, because you'll hear a lot of people say, oh, it was just a joke, and as if that implies that the other person can't be offended or hurt by it. But that's not true at all. To me, a joke is only a joke if both sides think it's a joke or feel that it's a joke. But if you say a joke to someone and they are hurt by it, that's no longer a joke. That could feel like an insult or a slight or something painful to them, and that's no longer a joke. And so I've seen this a lot in therapy, or you just hear people say in general that they say something the other person is hurt by, and they say, well, it was a joke, and that's it, and that's the end of the discussion. So to me, a joke has to go both ways for it to really be a joke in the way that I think is quite positive, or else it's just teasing, or often a veiled way of expressing something we want to say, or taking out some anger on someone. Humor is a great way to do that. And there is some of that in most humor, but so this is where there's a lot of gray area of, well, when is it appropriate? When is it across the line? There isn't a clear indicator of that where you can say that is too far. But I would say always the recipient can let you know how they felt about it and if they were okay with it or not. And that is the line, and that's how we should measure it. So, you know, we often hear people say there's truth to every joke. If someone says something mean or harsh, I think there is truth to that adage that there's truth to every joke. Doesn't mean every joke needs to be psychoanalyzed. I'm sure I've been guilty of that before. But it does mean that almost always there's going to be something that's being revealed in the joke. And a joke or humor is a great way to say something out loud that you might be afraid to say out loud, or to say something out loud that you think inside your head but are afraid to say any other way or to say directly. And so we see this happen often where someone will say something kind of in a joking way, but we can tell they're really serious and they're trying to just get a gauge of how the other person or people are going to respond to them saying that thing. So a joke, wonderful, great, we should tease one another, but we always have to be aware of how the other person feels about it. And that should be important to you. And it can be good, again, that we have to psychoanalyze every joke we say or anyone says, but to be aware of that. If you notice you keep teasing someone about the same thing or keep making jokes about the same thing, there could be something there. So you often will see someone keeps making a certain type of joke, or they tease someone in a certain way. And often we can see that there might be some directive thought there, that they're trying to get something out or get some narrative out. Sometimes they might not even be aware of it. It might be unconscious, but there might be something to it there. Now, if we come to pranks, and so April Fools, it's often about doing pranks. People do them year round, but April Fools, this April 1st, can be the day to do those things even more or feel like they're excused. And that's an issue I have. But one thing you see in reactions to it, or even in planning of it, is such a disconnect and such a lack of empathy in executing a prank. In the sense that, yes, of course, if you want to do any kind of prank or joke, and I've done them in my life for sure, and some that are even a little bit more extreme, and it's been a while since I've done probably one that was more extreme, but I do think it can be quite fun. So I'm not against them altogether. But I do think it's important to be aware of, or something that people don't do, where they think, well, it's a joke, so it doesn't matter what happens or what I say, because at the end I'm going to say it's a joke. And that is completely missing the experience of the other person, because you know it's a joke the whole time. So you're going to tell someone this extreme thing or have something look like it's happening when it's not happening. Some of the more horrible ones I've seen online was a guy put a doll that looked like his girlfriend's dog underneath her tire with kind of fake blood on it, so she would think she ran over her own dog, which is just horrific. I think I've mentioned this one on the show before, because when I saw it, I was just shocked. And she, of course, reacted so strongly because she thought she had killed her own dog. So her dog being dead and then thinking you killed your dog is just horrific. And then eventually, you know, she saw that it was a doll, or, you know, the boyfriend reveals that, no, it's not true. And then you just look at the comments. There are some people saying, that's horrible. What is he doing? That's not funny. And then so many people saying, oh, you're soft. It's a joke. Nothing happened to the dog. Everyone's okay. And to me, this is just so lacking in the empathy of recognizing what does someone go through when you go through that experience of thinking your dog has died and you killed your own dog. Yes, it's not true, so eventually she finds that out. But in that period before she finds out, it can be literally traumatic. It can be extremely harmful and hurtful in a very real way. What I think is interesting is that if someone were to be physically harmed, even if they got a cut or somehow got a, you know, hit in some way, people might say, oh, okay, they actually got hurt, which also, this is another huge distinction, something that since I've been doing this show, I've talked about often and frequently, is that we have such a strong bias towards physical pain being real and mental pain not being real or not being as serious or not mattering as much. So if someone emotionally goes through a lot, that doesn't matter as long as they weren't physically hurt. So the dog was physically okay. She was physically okay. So no victim. No, not at all. She had to go through something really painful during that period between she thought it was real and she found out it was fake, and who knows how much or how she recovered from that. It's really horrible, but that's something that people think is funny. To me, it's not funny at all. So if you're going to do a prank, of course, you know it's fake the whole time, or you know that nothing bad is happening if that's what you're doing, but you want to think about what is that other person's experience is where empathy comes in. You know it's not real, so you say, oh, nothing's going to happen, but what is it like for that person on the other end who, for whatever period of time, doesn't know it's real and what they will go through? And think about whatever horrific news you've gotten in your life. It wasn't that you had to wait an hour or 2 days to feel bad about it. As soon as you heard it, people share stories. As soon as I heard this news about my family member dying or this happening or that happening, I was devastated and what they went through. And so when we give someone fake bad news or fake whatever it is, they really go through that experience for that time, however long it is. So we should not minimize that. And so, yes, it's April Fool's, the day to do it. Somehow it makes it more okay, which it shouldn't, but people do this all the time. Another thing I see a lot is the things that people do to their babies and kids online. For example, putting some weird filter like where the face turns into a horse or turns into some kind of monster, or there's a spider crawling on, looks like a spider is crawling on your face, and you see the baby sometimes crying and screaming and freaking out, and even the parents laughing often. But then people in the comments, again, you'll see mix, some people saying this is child abuse, this is horrible, what are you doing? And then other people saying, oh, again, you guys are soft, this is nothing happened to them, why are you making it a big deal? So, but I'm definitely shocked when I see these videos that it is so painful and hurtful to this vulnerable child to scare them into thinking either there's a spider on their face, or that, you know, their face is changing in this way, or sometimes they see the parents face change on the screen and they're terrified and horrified. I just can't understand the justification that somehow this is okay. I also think it's so good to laugh and joke and have a good time, but there are so many ways to do it without harming someone else. So if you have to make someone feel really bad to laugh, that means you're not very funny or you're not very creative to come up with ways to think of something funny, think of something humorous that doesn't have to be at someone's expense, that someone doesn't have to hurt for you to feel good. That's a very weak form of humor. And I think there's so many other ways that you can be funny and do something funny and humorous. And then here with your kids, I do think there's very much this sense of almost a type of power trip that you feel big and powerful as the parent, and you're hurting your child. Even there could be something we all have unresolved about when we were weak and when we didn't have the power, and there's a way of asserting that in this moment. Because for me, it's shocking to see parents doing something that would scare their child, terrify them, and just think it's funny, or think and then think it's so funny to put it online, which is even worse. I think to do that, it's bad enough to do it, but then even worse to put it online. And to emphasize the point that these things are not minor, again, I know it could seem like a Debbie Downer position to be this against pranks, but I've met people, dealt with people who have been traumatized, experienced PTSD from something that was a prank. Even there's a story when we hear the term scared to death, there is a story of, this is many years ago, I think I read it in a psychology textbook, of a fraternity, and they're doing a type of hazing. And so they blindfolded one of the guys and tied him to a railroad track. And they knew that the train that was coming, he would hear a train coming, was going to turn and go on a different path. So it wasn't actually going to come and hit him. But he hears this train coming, he's blindfolded, and then, you know, the train goes the other way, and, you know, it finishes. They kind of tell him, oh, you know, the train's gone, it went on the other track, we knew it wasn't going to hit you. And he stands up, and then he collapses and he died. And so he was literally scared to death. So again, we might think, I know nothing is going to physically happen to him, so he's okay. But emotionally, psychologically, there's something going on that is physical too. Again, that interconnection is happening. Something is happening within him, and then he literally died, and so that happened. So it's not something just a laughing matter or a joke. And as I said, people get PTSD from, okay, we're going to pretend like, you know, someone broke into your house, or we're going to fake kidnap you, or do whatever, these kinds of things. And the people, again, because it feels real when it happened, the brain can't go back and reprocess, oh, this was a joke. We have these bad experiences. So as I'm wrapping up, remember, a joke is only a joke if it goes both ways, and a prank isn't fake the whole time to the person you're doing it to. It is real until they find out, and that's not something that doesn't leave a mark, even if the mark isn't physical. It could be psychological and emotional. All right, that brings us to the end of tonight's show. A big thank you to Farhuda here in the studio. You've been listening to In Session with Dr. Fadi Dalakwi. Zan Zendegi Azadi.